Sidebar, episode 150, Cliff Chang, sponsored by Graham Crackers Comics.
Welcome to Sidebar, four color conversations on comics, art, and pop culture, featuring creator interviews and roundtable discussion. For more information about Sidebar, stop by our website at sidebarnation.com. From the main page, you can find out more about us, contact the show, make a donation, or peruse our back episodes located in the archives. You can also find Sidebar on Facebook, Twitter, and the Visual Artists Podcast Network as well.
This is our anniversary, so.
Yeah.
Yeah, 150, bro.
Yeah.
Wow.
There you go. So that's why I was wanting to put the extra.
I didn't really think about it until Adrian brought it up, but yeah. So we're at the 150 mark.
Wow. Like it's an anniversary issue. It's a double size. Right. It's a
triple size. Yeah. Giant size annual sidebar. Right.
And I like how we added the currency of the month as far as being Black History Month. We had our version of that into it. Like we talked about, you know, stereotypes in comics and racial divisions and things of that nature. That was cool.
If we were to post it in February.
Yeah. The usual sidebar fashion.
Now we could clip it out and put it as an Easter egg on Norm.
On the upcoming episode of Sidebar.
Right. It's the precursor. It's the harbinger for the goodness that is on its way. Welcome back to Sidebar, the comics, art, and pop culture podcast, where we feature the best art literate talk in the cosmos.
Yep, in the galaxy.
In the universe.
Far, far away.
All those places.
Yeah, we occupy.
We're the host of the show. My name is Swain Hunt.
I'm Dwight.
And I'm Adrian.
And we are here to present you our interview with Mr. Cliff Chang, artist from Green Arrow, Black Canary, from Greendale, from Human Target, from Beware the Creeper.
Dr. 13.
Great cover artist, great interior artist. We had an awesome time chatting with him. Had actually met him a couple of times. Met him at Heroes Con. Mm-hmm. Maybe back in 2008, I think.
That sounds about right.
Yeah. And then I met him again in New York City at the New York City Comic Con. Mm-hmm. Very nice guy, very affable. And everybody who knows Cliff has nothing but nice things to say about him. Mm-hmm. And a friend of his calls him Cliffy.
Cliffy. So. Which we won't call.
Well, yeah, we didn't call him Cliffy.
Well, actually, we did, just by mentioning it. So.
But before we get to our interview with Cliff, we want to talk about our sponsor, which is Graham Crackers.
Just comics.
Now, you know, fellas, y'all, you know, go ahead and let's see.
Break
pull a card. There we go.
Right.
Break red, red, red.
Yes, you know.
I got the shortest one. So I guess I have to go first.
No, Mm-hmm. Now, I don't know about you guys, but I like Graham Crackers.
I do too.
Me too.
It's tight, you know?
Yeah, man.
Now,
especially with cinnamon sprinkles, you know?
Yeah, with the cinnamon and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Graham Crackers Comics has been our sponsor for a while.
Mm-hmm.
They've been in business a long time.
Mm-hmm.
You can get all your new comics from Graham Crackers. Hold on a second. You can get all your new comics from Graham Crackers Comics.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Tons of back issues, trades, comics, and collectibles.
Mm-hmm.
You can definitely go to their website, which is GrahamCrackers.com.
Mm-hmm.
If you go to... Hold on a second.
You have 9 brick-and-mortar stores.
Mm-hmm. Well, have another one, D.
No, I think I will. Yeah. Thanks.
If you go to the search bar...
I'm trying to get it there.
And you put in Cliff Chang's name.
Mm-hmm.
They probably have some of everything we just mentioned available in their inventory.
Mm-hmm.
Send it right to your doorstep. Again, along with your... Hold on a second. Yeah. Along with the new comic.
All Cliff Chang's books.
All the Cliff Chang's books that you want.
Sure.
Go to GrahamCrackers.com
and
make it happen.
We figured in honor of our 150th show that we would, you know, spark up some interest with our actual Graham Crackers.
Yeah, eating some actual Graham Crackers on the mic. Now, we're not trying to be rude, but...
Right.
I mean, they're damn good. Graham Crackers is awesome.
Yeah, and as and as we mentioned in the conversation, you can also find books by Rude there as well. Steve Rude, that is. Cheers, John.
But in all seriousness, Cliff Chang is, as we mentioned before, you'll know his work from Green Arrow, Black Canary, as I mentioned earlier, Human Target, Dr. 13, lots of titles. And he does a lot of covers for DC right now.
Mm-hmm.
He said he was born in New Jersey, or raised in New Jersey. He lives in Brooklyn, New York now. Most of his work primarily has been for DC Comics, although he did work as an editor for a short time for DC Adventures Magazine and for Vertigo.
Mm-hmm.
Really nice guy, really talented artist. Mm-hmm. In our conversation with him, you know, we talk about the books he's worked on. We talk about his background. He's educated at Harvard. He has a degree in English and in visual arts.
Mm-hmm.
We talk about, you know, transitioning from a guy who working as an associate editor into being a freelancer. Talked a little bit about his process and his approach to storytelling. And we also talked, the tail end of the interview, we started talking about Secret Identities. It's an anthology that he worked on with a bunch of other Asian creators, celebrating some Asian superheroes that they created.
Mm-hmm. Asian-American.
Asian-American superheroes. Yeah, I stand corrected. And we got into an interesting discussion about that, too. But anyway, Cliff's a wonderful guy, super nice, super talented. You definitely need to check his stuff out wherever you can.
Mm-hmm.
And we hope everybody enjoys the interview. And we're going to probably pick things up with Cliff talking about, you know, his background and how he grew up and that whole all that stuff. So.
And how Arbor is such an interesting school, including a great art school as well.
Exactly. So, ladies and gentlemen, this is Cliff Chang.
The interview.
I don't know. I guess growing up, I never really thought seriously about being an artist professionally. You know, it's kind of like one of these things that you do on the side. And you know, I was always enjoyed it, but I never really, you know, thought I would go into it. So, you know, going into school and being at school with so many other people who were more, I don't know, either inclined, you know, towards, you know, business or medicine and stuff like that, I just never really considered being an artist. So, yeah, I figured I'd become a lawyer. What else are you going to do with a law degree, right? With an English degree.
Right. Well, tell us, at what point did the course change for you where you said, okay, maybe I am going to try to explore this visual arts thing more so than the English part?
Yeah, I started off just concentrating in English my freshman year, and then by my sophomore year, I just realized I needed something else. And that I wanted to be drawing a bit more. I'd kind of rediscovered it, you know, in my freshman year.
Mm-hmm.
I had started reading comics again. Actually, I hadn't read them all through high school, and I got to college, and you know, you've got a couple extra bucks. What are you going to do? You know, you're going to spend it on, you know, I was freshman year, so I wasn't going out buying beer, so the easiest thing to do was, you know, go out. I was either buying CDs or buying comics, and you know, so I started drawing again, and so I kind of rediscovered, you know, how much I loved comics. It was, you know, all the Vertigo stuff that was coming out at the time, Sandman and Hellblazer, and I think Preacher had started, I don't remember, but, you know, I really kind of fell back in love with it, so it was... at that point, I guess, you know, in my sophomore year, I decided I wanted to do more artwork. So I was able to kind of major in both art and English.
Mm-hmm. What kind of art courses did you take? I know the standard usual things you usually take when you're discovering art, you know, the anatomy courses, the figure drawing courses, and so on and so forth. What kind of art department would you say that Harvard has, or did you take it at Harvard?
They're not really geared towards, you know, they always like to say that they're not a trade school, which is like kind of like their way of kind of skirting around the subject. You
sure,
know, they don't actually have,
yeah.
You know. And so, you know, they do a lot of fine art stuff, and they do a whole bunch of studio courses. But you know, they're not as strong as say something, you know, some of the other schools like Yale, or if you go to Brown, you can also take classes at RISD.
Mm.
So it. My coursework there was, you know, there was a bunch of figure drawing, and then what I ended up settling into was printmaking. I really enjoyed that whole process, and thinking about prints, and even then, kind of in some way about like multiples of images,
right?
You know, how you go about like creating them, and do you, you know, how you can make them different, and how you know the whole process of printing was really great.
Mm. Cliff, what did your parents think when you were getting ready to switch from your rather you know your English pursuits to the art and all that kind of stuff?
Yeah, no, it's that's a good question. I was pretty nervous about that myself for a little while.
Right.
I was pretty upfront with them. I said, you know, I want to take some more art courses. If you know, I'll still continue on this path of like going, you know, going towards law school and stuff like that. But you know, I want to, you know, at least give this a shot. You know,
right?
and you know, and they went with it. And you know, and honestly, I was not like trying to pull one over on them at all. You know, like
okay.
It was just, you know, like I was actually very, you know, because I didn't know what I was going to do. And you know, if you think about it, like the numbers of people who, you know, want to draw comics versus the ones who are actually doing it, it's, you know, I mean, it is a pretty small number.
Yeah.
You know, of course anybody can, you know, can go and put out their own book, you know, but you know, at that point I was really, you know, thinking about trying to break in at Marvel or DC.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So I knew that the chances were pretty slim.
Okay.
So, you know, I was going to be, I wanted to be realistic about it.
After you graduated, now what was your plan after you got your degree and said, okay, I'm actually going to do the art thing? Like, what was your plan of attack from that point?
It's funny, I actually wasn't, even then, like, I wasn't really fully into, invested in being an artist. I graduated having, you know, already taken the LSAT and having applied to law school. I got into Columbia and NYU and decided to go to NYU because it was downtown. Which just shows you, like, you know, how screwed up my, you know, my priorities were. It's like, you know, so, you know, I thought I'd have a better time. at NYU, so I went with that, and I managed to convince them that I was going to defer for 2 years. So I was already in, but I wasn't going to enroll for another 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I told them that I wanted to kind of get some work experience, and they said okay. I started working at an ad firm as a junior art director, like real like bottom, you know, lowest rung of the ladder, pretty much.
Mm-hmm.
And I did that for about 6 months while I was waiting to kind of find a job in comics. In my one of my summers in college, I interned at Marvel for the summer with and under Joey Cavalieri.
Mm-hmm.
And it was great. And you know, I kept in touch with Joey, and eventually Joey put me in touch with Heidi McDonald's, and I started working with her at Disney Adventures magazine as an assistant editor. So I spent about 6 months in advertising, and then about 9 months with Heidi at Disney.
Okay.
Now, how often were you sending in samples, Cliff, to both, I would presume, Marvel and DC? And what type of samples were they? Were they just strictly pencils or pencils and ink?
Yeah, no, that's a good question. I think I didn't send in a lot of samples. I knew I was working on stuff, but, like, really, like, I figured, you know, as much as I wanted to draw, I knew that I wasn't there yet, and so like there wasn't really any point in sending off samples.
Mm-hmm.
If you knew they weren't going to look at them anyway. So I actually figured my best shot at getting into the industry in some form or another, whether or not I was going to be eventually drawing, was as an assistant editor.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because I had the English degree, because I had an art degree, you know, and because I went to an Ivy League school. Like, that's the kind of thing that, like, I knew, like, resume-wise, like, that was going to be more impressive than me sending out some crappy, you know, crappy pages of Daredevil, which is, I think, what I did show Joey, and he was, like, after I graduated, I think, or maybe it was, it was probably the year after I interned with him. So it was, like, my senior year, and I sent some pages to Joe, and he was like, yeah, these are, you know, these are okay. And I was, I didn't really know how or what I wanted to draw, really, at that point.
Okay.
And you know, they kind of had, like, a bad Steve Rude meets Image vibe to them. It was weird.
That's an interesting
pedigree. It was a weird fit.
Yeah,
you know, because I really liked some of the, you know, the bolder graphic approach, but then it was like, you know, but like, you know, with like Liefeld anatomy, you know, so.
Okay.
Rob gets slammed again.
Hey, Cliff, you worked for a while at Vertigo as an editor too, right?
Yeah. After working at with Heidi for 9 months, I think I got a job with Stuart Moore at Vertigo.
Okay.
Assisting him, so that's when I moved over to DC.
Now I'm just curious because obviously, you know, in the back of your mind, and maybe not in the back of your mind, I mean, it was just kind of simmering on the back burner. You were kind of preparing yourself and kind of desiring to be a freelance artist. And it seems like, okay, like, why would you want to leave what we were presumed to be the, you know, the staff gig for the uber stable life of a freelancer? You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah, no, it was tricky. I spent about 2 years at DC, and I really enjoyed it, and it was like really the best place I could learn about comics, about really making comics, you know, seeing how the machine works and seeing all this artwork that would come past my desk. You know, a lot of the assistant editor's job is kind of, you know, getting the artwork in, shrinking it down, you know, doing lettering placements, you know, with the script, so you're figuring out where all the lettering goes, and in the process of doing that, you're able to examine every one of the artist's storytelling styles.
Mm-hmm.
So within like 2 years, yeah, it was really like, it was like boot camp, because you'd see how people, you'd know the script really well, and then you'd see what the artist came up with. You'd see the ones who were lazy, you'd see the ones who went above and beyond, you know, so you got this whole variety of styles that you could check out, and a whole range of abilities. So it was really cool. It was a great opportunity to learn. So I did that for 2 years, and I think probably about like a year in, I started drawing more regularly. I mean, I was doing it up until then, but I started putting together like mini comics that I would give out to some of the other editors who knew that I was drawing, and trying to get some feedback from them. You know, at the same time, like a friend of mine, Jim Higgins, was working on the Big Book series.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
And he was able to, you know, there's so many stories in those books, so he was able to, I was able to get like a couple of those under my belt, and you know, and I felt pretty good about it. So, you know, by the time I left DC, I didn't have anything lined up, but I certainly felt that it was worth taking a shot, because if I was going to, if I was ever going to do it, it had to be then, because I was still young enough to like not be like worrying about like too much stuff, you know. I wasn't trying to raise a family or something like that.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
And a friend of mine just the other day mentioned it's like your mid-20s freak out.
Yeah.
Where it's like, you know, you get some crappy job like right out of school, and then like after a couple of years, you're wondering like, is this what I'm going to be doing for the rest of my life? And then you kind of run off and do something else, you know.
Yeah.
And that's what it was for me. I mean, as much as I enjoyed my time at DC, I knew that I didn't want to be on staff, you know, forever. And then if I needed to, you know, if I was going to draw anything, I needed to be doing it full time and not just at night whenever I could find, you know, steal an hour or two.
Mm-hmm.
That was the other thing. So if I was going to be drawing a book, I was up against someone else who would be able to turn it around in a month, whereas it would take me twice as long because I was working during the day. So
right.
Just in terms of like, you know, I was taking myself out of competition, you know, by keeping a day job there.
Mm-hmm. So in terms of your editing, initially, and like you said, you had a chance to really examine and see a lot of different artists and what their processes were as they came across your desk. I mean, did that affect your process in terms of your own penciling, I guess, when the time came for you to lay something down concrete and make your own statement as far as art goes?
It's a good question. I mean, there were certainly, you know, I think what was great was I got to know and see the work of like a bunch of really, really great artists who I really respected, and I met a bunch of them, and they were all really encouraging about the work, and I felt like, you know, they didn't necessarily need to be, and that gave me kind of like gave me more confidence to go off on my own in terms of like the actual time there and affecting like how I do stuff. I'm very aware of like the pipeline, you know, so like getting them work, making sure that, you know, it's I send them balloon places myself, so I know where they're going to be placing, you know,
cool.
What artwork's going to be covered up and stuff like that. It's all like, you know, these are things that you should do as an artist, because that design is part of your job, you know. So even if someone else is lettering it, you know, you have to provide space for it, and you have to know, and if you don't, you're being lazy, and honestly, like, it'll show too. So
it seems almost like it's presumptuous upon the artist to think that the entire panel or sequence of panels is about them, when it's an equal sharing process with the writer and with everything else that goes on as far as design goes.
Yeah, you do. You know, you do have to be. You have to be aware of the production process. You know, and to know that you know there are people coming after you, and you have to make. You know, you can't make. You got to make their life as easy as possible too. You know,
most definitely. Cliff, we've heard that some of your influences are folks like John Byrne and Paul Smith, I guess, back in the day. And then you've mentioned other names here and there, like Milo Manara and Jorge Savino and even the great Robert McGinnis.
Nice.
Who we worship.
Yes.
That's awesome. That's great. Yeah, no, he's fantastic. I mean, I'm really actually getting into 60s painters and illustrators a lot these days, and, you know, just to see like how they're doing things. It's really striking work.
Any Bob Peake love in there?
Yes.
Oh yeah, sure.
There you go. You have to.
Yeah, Bernie Fuchs, you know, yes. all those guys. It's just, you know, it's really tremendous work, and it can, you know, all the stuff that, you know, I see when, you know, when I'm looking at their work, like I know that, you know, if I can even apply some of what they were doing, you know, to comics, you'll end up with like a really, you know, different kind of animal. So, yeah. You know, it's a constant source of inspiration.
One of the things that I really liked, Cliff, just as a sidetrack, was your covers for Green Arrow, Black Canary.
Oh, thanks.
Yeah, really rich and illustrative, and, you know, you could see a different side of your brain working, it seemed, than, you know, the interior stuff that you do for the stories, because you were thinking more like, you know, like an illustrator. You know, I've got to get some kind of story in one image as opposed to a sequence of images. So I really liked those covers, and I liked, you know, like if you go from the very first one you did to, I think you worked all the way up to maybe issue 15 or something like that.
Yeah, think about that. Yeah.
Yeah, they were just tremendous and kind of designy. Maybe your printmaking background or whatever, you know, had some play in that as well, but very good.
Thanks. Yeah, it was doing all those covers, I think, really helped me figure out, like, I learned a lot about color. Mm-hmm. I learned a lot about, like, you know, my work and how to, like, kind of play with it a little bit more. It was great. It was a great opportunity. I'm glad they let me do those covers, and it really helped, I guess, helped me establish a voice.
Yeah.
You know, as far as, like, you know, because when you're just doing the interior book, yeah, people might not notice, you know, your work as much because it's behind somebody else's cover. And I think, you know, we were able to give that book, like, a real clear identity.
Yeah, most definitely. Let's talk about some of the titles that you did work on, Cliff, because I first got introduced to your work on Beware the Creeper back in 2003, but you had worked a little bit, I guess, before that. Is that correct?
Yeah, before Beware the Creeper, I was kind of picking up like short jobs here and there. I was the first thing I did after leaving staff was a story in Flinch. Number 11, which is like a four pager.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It was fun. Probably that issue is more well known for like having this really awesome Bruce Timm story in it. That was a really great story. I remember it was like so rough that they couldn't, like, they wanted to use it for a romance title, and then they were like, no, this is too fucked up. So they ended up putting it into a horror anthology. That's how bad it was. But it was a brilliant story, and I was so happy to finally see that in print, and that it happened to be the same issue that I was in. I was like, oh great! I was like, oh, this really, I'm not going to look good at all next to this. Then after that, I did a double page spread for Transmetropolitan. I Hate It Here, which is like that first book that they had of like all the different contributors.
Yeah.
Which was cool because I worked as an editor on that book. And then when I left, they were able to, you know, they needed someone to do this double page spread, and I was like, all right, you know, and then they offered it to me, and I was like, this is fantastic. So,
little nepotism there,
right? Yeah, a little bit.
It works.
That's it.
Now I noticed, Cliff, on like your earlier work, like Beware the Creeper, it was seemed like a very brush driven style. Maybe not quite as refined as your later work, you know, but there was an energy that I really liked to that Beware the Creeper stuff, you know. What were you using around that time as far as like your inking? Was it just a brush or?
Yeah, it's my tools haven't changed that much over the years. Yeah, mostly brush, and then, you know, maybe probably a little, you know, a couple like micron pens here and there. you know. But yeah, that was pretty much what I was using at that point. Mostly brush.
That's great. Was Beware the Creeper, was that your first? I don't know. I guess it was 5 issues, correct?
Yeah, it was my first miniseries. Where I was, you know, my name was, you know, on the cover and all that kind of stuff.
Front and center.
Yeah.
Most definitely.
That's cool.
I think also, too, man, for artwork-wise, because Adrian's talking about the style on Beware the Creeper, and it was kind of brushy and a little bit rougher. Mm-hmm. But I think things really kind of came together on Human Target, which was one of my favorites.
Yeah.
Well, thanks.
And Peter Milligan, he's a really good writer, and I like the way that he and I think it was Javier Pulido started the series. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like the way that they freaked the concept of the Human Target. Do you enjoy working on stories with, and do you enjoy working on them equally, stories with non-powered characters like Christopher Chance and traditional superhero fare like on Green Arrow, Black Canary, and so forth?
Yeah, I do. It really just depends on the story. If it's a good story, then it's fun to draw. Mm-hmm. If it's not, then it's like pulling teeth, you know. So I've drawn enough stories where, you know, where it's something like Human Target, where there are no superpowers, and it's really fun. And I've drawn other stories where, you know, they might feature, you know, some of my favorite characters, but because the stories are so bad, there's no, you know, every day is a slog, and you're drawing stuff, you know, it, you know, it's horrible. Like, you know, if I were, like, you know, to go back in time and, like, you know, my 10-year-old self were to, you know, come to the future and see me now and, like, you know, me trying to, like, grind out a day working on a page, you'd be horrified, you know? And it's like, you're drawing comics, you should be really happy. And there's part of me that always recognizes that, you know, I'm really lucky to be doing what I'm doing.
Yeah.
But there's part of me that's also wants to do good work.
Mm-hmm.
And when you have a bad story, that's square one, you know? If you have a bad story, there's only so much drawing you can do to make it better. You know, it's still never going to come together as a piece, as decent comics.
That's true.
So when it's a good story, that's really the best thing you can ask for.
Yeah. You know, Adrian's talking about the inking, Cliff, and while we're at it, this is kind of more of a process question, but you've pretty much been inking your own stuff since, like, forever.
Yeah. There's only been a couple times where I haven't inked myself. I find it, like, really... inking is drawing, you know. Everything else that I do up till then, all the penciling, is really a form of planning, you know. It's you're doing all that work so that when you get to the inks, you can draw and you don't have to think too much, and you can just kind of react to what's on the page.
Right.
It's actually really great to hear you say that, you know, you know, really like the inks on Beware the Creeper, and whatever roughness was there also gave a lot of energy, because I'm trying to get back to that now, you know, try and combine the better drafting that I'm capable of now with some freer, you know, rougher inks. So I've been, you know, you can kind of see myself go from, you know, one end of the spectrum to the other. And then, you know, I guess right now it's a pendulum swing, and now, you know, trying to come back to something with a little bit more energy to it.
It's funny you should say that, because that was going to be one of the things I was going to bring up later as far as Zatanna goes. Like, you started with Beware the Creeper, and it was kind of the brushy thing, and then your style got really clean and very, very, like, specific in the middle there with Dr. 13 and going into Green Arrow, Black Canary. And now on Zatanna, you see more of a scratchier line and a rougher line, and things look a bit looser, kind of like they did. So I would say it's like a pendulum swing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's, you know, it was, I think, because when I started on Human Target, I was really trying to make sure that even though Javier and I, our stuff doesn't look that similar, I tried to keep it, like, in the same tone, I guess, those first few issues.
Mm-hmm.
And then by issue 10, I realized that, you know, I wasn't really happy with the way it was looking.
Mm-hmm.
I'm still proud of the work, but, like, it didn't. It felt like me trying to do something else. Like, you know, Javier had really stripped down his style at that point. It was really graphic and cool to look at, and I was kind of in between, you know. And I realized I couldn't follow him in that, you know, in that direction. That I kind of need to go and become my own guy. So, with issue 10, I started focusing more on the drafting, doing finer lines, and then you can see it progressively get, like, tighter and tighter as you know, until the end of the book, really.
Yeah, and that's part of the thing is that a lot of people don't understand that you have to have some type of draftsmanship underpinning those inks. Mm-hmm. Like a lot of people who see like artists who are very, you know, energetic with their inks. The reason they have the freedom to be energetic is that it's underpinned by draftsmanship.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Even like you said, Jorge Safino earlier, it's one of your influences. You look mm-hmm. at his stuff, and to the layperson, they might say, oh, it's messy, it's mm-hmm. disorganized, but it's really not. That man can draw.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And
yeah.
Over that, you know, he has, over, you know, his solid pencils, he has this very loose, energetic inking. Mm-hmm. So there is a difference. And I think, yeah, that's definitely what occurred with your work, Cliff.
Yeah, I think, you know, I wasn't, you know, my drafting wasn't good enough to simplify that much at that point. And so, you know, I started, probably not even consciously, but, you know, working more on the drafting mm-hmm. at that point and going towards thinner lines. And it's been for me, I'm always kind of pulled in a couple different directions. One is like this really stark graphic look. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, and then the other direction is kind of like, you know, like this clear line, you know, style that I've loved, you know, with somebody like, you know, like Steve Rood or Paul Smith, you know, where mm-hmm. it really is so elegant looking, and that will always appeal to me. But, you know, so between that and then trying to get control over the my tools as well, you know, like I'm much better with the brush now than I was, you know, 10 years ago. So it's been a real like learning experience and it's been cool, but you know, I changed my mind a lot, you know, I mean, I guess, you know, that's my prerogative, I suppose, you know, right. Hopefully people, you know, will come along with me, you know?
Oh, most definitely. It's his prerogative, like Bobby Brown. Cliff, man, let's talk. You talk about fun stories, man. Let's talk about Dr. 13.
Yeah.
Because mm-hmm. that was a hoot, sir. Yes. I've been telling these guys about the story in the book because, oddly enough, Brandon Montclair, the mm-hmm. The assistant editor on the book, mm-hmm. Sent me a copy of it years ago.
Ah, all right.
He was like, oh, you should read it. It's really good. And I read it, and I really enjoyed it. And I saw it's the guy from the Creeper series. I mean, that's basically who you were in my mind at that time.
Yeah.
But anyway, it was really cool. You and Azarello really, really knocked it out. Now, did Brandon and Bob Schreck, did they ask you to get on that book? Or did you have a kind of a rapport with Brian and say, hey, let's do something at some point, and then maybe he pulled you in? Or how'd that happen?
Yeah. Combination of both? I don't know. Maybe that's I'm not trying to hedge it.
Okay.
But no, actually, I'd been talking, you know, I'd worked with Bob and Brandon a couple of times already. I worked with Bob a bunch of times and with Brandon a few times before that.
Mm-hmm.
And they knew I was kind of looking for stuff to do. And I was, and I've known Brian for a while. I was the assistant, I was assisting on 100 Bullets when that started out.
Mm. Oh, cool.
So, you know, yeah, so I knew Brian, you know, from way back, which was cool, you know. And
yeah.
And he ended up calling me up, and asked me if I was interested in doing something for this you know this book that they were doing. And I guess I'd heard about it and wasn't quite sure. And then I'd heard, you know, Bob hadn't really said anything to me, but I knew he was trying to get like Bernie Wrightson for something, you know. So I was like,
wow,
right, you know. So
we have the
like,
big guns, you know.
Yeah, because that book was supposed to be, you know, kind of a horror book, right?
Yeah.
You had the Spectre as a lead story, and then it was going to be whatever Azarello was going to write.
Right.
So in your head, you're thinking, all right, I've got Dave Lapham, you know, writing the Spectre. I've got Brian Azarello drawing something.
Right.
I'm writing something, you know. Yeah, yeah. So this book is going to kick ass, and it's going to be like, you know, it's going to be so dark and gritty.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think the way the story goes is they were, you know, looking at characters for him to do, you know, and it's like, you know, maybe they're looking at like Phantom Stranger or something like that, you know. And there was this long list of characters that like you couldn't use because they were too tied up in like 52. At the time, and because you know, Grant, Greg, and Mark and Jeff were using them,
right.
And then I think there are probably three or four rounds where like Brian was suggesting, oh, well, you know, what about that guy? And then Bob's like, nah, you know, can't use that guy. And then so eventually he's like, ah, who are they not using?
Right.
Okay. Give me the list of people they're never going to use. And as it happened, there was a list of like characters that were not being used.
Yes, right. yes. That's what's up.
So he picked those guys, and then he called me up, and he's like, "Do you want to do this book?" I'm like, "Well, what is it?" He's like, "Well, it's like Johnny Quest meets Adult Swim." I'm like,
that's a perfect.
I was like, all right, well, this is like, sounds like, you know, kind of like Venture Brothers.
Right,
like
Venture Brothers.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah. He's like, you'll get to draw all this shit that no one, you know, will ever, that you never get to draw. You get to draw a vampire, you get to draw a pirate ship, you get to draw a caveman and a gorilla, you know?
Yeah, for anybody who hadn't read the book, that was the thing. It's like, it wasn't even like B-level, C-level characters. It was like, okay, turn to the back of the list. These are the L and Z-level characters. And you had like I, Vampire, and Anthro.
Captain Fear, my favorite.
Captain Fear, yeah. Infectious Last.
Infectious Last. Yeah.
whose power it is to make you sick.
Yeah. Well, they were, it's funny, because even the cast, like in the first few... chapter, I think, like it had changed up. Like we were going to be, who did we have? It wasn't even a girl. Actually, we showed Infectious Last in silhouette.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
And then I don't remember if this is in the book, but I think I showed like one of the original pencils, maybe for that page.
Mm-hmm.
And it was supposed to be Buona Beast.
Mm.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it was going to be like. It was just going to be, we were going to, because, you know, he was another guy that, like, nobody was using, and we were going to use him to make some
with his yellow and black
literally off-color joke, you know? Yeah. And then it turned out, like, Brian looked at it, he's like, this is just a sausage party, we need another girl. we were going to use, Silver Banshee?
Yeah. Okay.
Brian's Silver Banshee. Superman villain.
Yeah.
And then we found out we couldn't use her, so then I still kept the silhouette, and then I just, you know, and then I remembered I'd done a sketch of Infectious Last for a fan in San Diego one year, and the character really stuck with me, and I just thought, you know, how great would it be to use one of these kind of, you know, unsung, you know, Legion heroes, and you know, and he just fell in love with her whole power and being able to make jokes about it. So, you know, she ended up getting in there, and she, you know, she was definitely one of my favorites to draw.
For anybody who doesn't know, the book, the stories appeared in Tales of the Unexpected, right?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
And then they were collected later into the trade. But there is actually a joke in the story where she says, "Oh, I'll never know the touch of a man," and then iVampire says, "Have you thought about changing your name?"
Yeah,
because I suppose she could give you any kind of disease. So,
well, changing your name and changing your clothes, because that green. Sorry, it's just, you know, it's not attractive.
That's it, man. And I actually reread that recently in preparation to speak with you, Cliff. And in my mind, what happened was I've started casting Terry 13 as the guy who played horn rimmed glasses on Heroes.
Oh yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
Look like him, yeah.
So he would kind of been, you know, Dr. 13 in my mind.
Okay.
He kind of had that that vibe.
Okay.
Yeah, he'd be pretty good.
Yeah. Anyway, it was a great series. It was a great collection of stories. Had a lot of humor. The breaking of the fourth wall, so to speak, mm-hmm. and even the last page of the story was just, I mean, it was just a riot.
Thanks. I think, you know, what was great about it is that it got, you know, it gave Brian a chance to show his sense of humor, and people really weren't expecting it, you know?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's true.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, speaking of Infectious Lasses, you did an editorial GQ with Lady Gaga.
That's right.
That was kind of rude, but, you know, just the same. It's all in good humor. How'd that come about? Because it was very interesting.
I've wanted to do magazine illustration for a while, and as it turns out, I have a friend who works at GQ, and he was able to. They needed something. They needed something very specifically, you know, this comic book style. So they, you know, it was for the year end issue, and they wanted to kind of, you know, it was for a gag about like what Lady Gaga would be doing in 2011. So they sent me the idea. They sent me the script, and, you know, I was like, cool. And then, you know, just kind of went to it, just using, you know, kind of, they had jokes that were they had written the jokes already, and I just kind of needed to find outfits that would go with those jokes.
Right. Mm-hmm. And this is a very tame outfit by comparison to what she usually wears.
Yeah,
shows. But it's,
yeah.
But it's a very good example of what you could do editorially. You know, I was wondering if there's going to be any more of that stuff in your future, possibly. I'd like to see that.
I'd like to do more of that. I end up doing so much comics work. It's hard to find time to do side things like that, mm-hmm. particularly because they usually need you to turn them around much faster because it's the nature of their business.
Mm-hmm.
Comparatively, so it can be hard to like take time and just jump on something else when you have to have to turn in a book like that that week as well.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But yeah, hopefully I can do more in the future.
Nice,
Cliff. I want to ask you some more about Green Arrow, Black Canary.
Sure.
You worked on like seven issues of that, and then you did covers for it afterwards for a good long while. But and Judd Winnick was the writer on the book. Did you know going into it that it was going to be have some of the elements in it that it did in terms of Oliver's relationship obviously with Dinah, but also his relationship with Connor Hawke and that whole thing, and the father son and all that.
Short answer would be no.
Okay.
the long answer is I spoke with Judd about the book. The way I got on that book was I had done a piece at Heroes Con a bunch of years ago for their auction,
mm-hmm.
and Dan DiDio saw it and liked it, and was like, we need to get you on one of these DCU books. And I was like, sure, whatever you want, I'm working on this, on something right now, but let me know, and then I'd love to, to get something going.
Yeah.
I ended up doing a commission for somebody that had Green Lantern and Green Arrow, I showed that to Dan, he took the art and just walked straight down to Mike Carlin. He says, "We got our guy for Green Arrow, Black Canary."
Oh, nice.
Which was great. And I was like, I was surprised by it as well. I didn't realize, they would just throw me on a monthly book like that,
mm-hmm.
But I was, frankly, I was actually kind of surprised that Dan liked my art so much. But he's been a great supporter, and if it weren't for working on that book, I think a lot fewer people would know my work.
Mm-hmm.
So for Green Arrow and Black Canary, I got on that book, and then I was talking to Judd about the story, and I said, "Well, what's this book going to be like?" And he says, "Well, it's going to be like, married couple, almost, going on adventures and it's really going to focus on their relationship too. So it's going to be like that show Heart to Heart." And I was like, "That's fantastic. That's great. That's a cool show. I like that cool show. And
yeah.
Moonlighting meets Heart to Heart."
Mr. and Mrs. H.
I was like, that's great. You got like personality. You've got like, you got adventures. This is going to be, this is going to be a really fun book."
Wow.
And then the book starts and it's like knee deep in like, crisis stuff that was happening at the time, and so like it starts off and like we think Green Arrow's dead, but he's not, and then
it was an imposter.
He's running after him, so they're not actually together until like the third or fourth issue, and then all the stuff happens with Connor, and then and the book kind of goes off in its own direction, and I was I remember thinking like, wow, this is not that's not like Moonlighting meets Heart to Heart at all. and ended up talking to Judd later, and I was like, I didn't ask him what was going on with the book, but I was asking him like, what other stuff he was working on. He's like, "Oh, I got like a TV pilot, like, in the works, and I was like, "Oh, that's great, it's like, I knew that he'd been wanting to do stuff, outside of comics as well."
Mm-hmm.
And to have sold like a pilot at any stage or something is a really tough thing, and I was like, "Oh, that sounds great! Like, what is it?" He's like, "Oh, it's a show about married secret agents."
Oh.
I was like, "Really? What's it like?" And he's like, "Well, it's great. It's actually like kind of like Moonlighting meets Heart to Heart." At that point, I just let it go. I was like, sure. No, good. I'm glad you got to use those stories somewhere.
Right?
You're such a tease.
That's funny.
Was it fun, or was it arduous getting to draw the entire JLA like you did near the middle of that run when Connor has his his well, he didn't die, but he ended up like brain dead basically. But
yeah, yeah. It was fun actually because, you know, in that book, you know, up to that point, you'd seen, you know, like my take on most of the characters, but then, like, you know, putting them in the context of, you know, what do they look like when Superman's in the room, you know?
Right.
What does Black Canary look like when she's standing next to Wonder Woman? And then, so that was like, that was fun, you know, and, and also to put them in such a weird place, like a hospital. Like, I really wanted to kind of like show how like incongruous it was, you know, because everyone knows, you know, how kind of dreary and institutional hospitals are, you know, but when you put like these bright colored guys there, like how, you know, how jarring is that and how, you know, what does that do? Mm-hmm. So it was fun. It was definitely fun, but it was tough because I think that issue was starting to run a little behind, and I was dealing with some stuff. Like, my mom was diagnosed with breast cancer at that point, and we were taking her to the hospital for surgery and stuff like that. So I was, like, drawing a book about being in the hospital and then, like, dealing with that, like, on the side. It was, like, it was a total, like, mind fuck. But, and it made it hard to, you know, I mean, I guess emotionally, yeah, it was hard to deal with that stuff. But at the same time, it's like I'd been in a hospital so recently, like all the reference was like really fresh in my mind. Mm-hmm. So, but, you know, to be in there and then be drawing this like highly charged story about, you know, Green Lantern, you know, more or less, you know, kind of realizing that he hasn't, you know, lived up to, you know, as a father for his son. It was really, really emotional. And I think maybe some of what I was going through at that time, you know, made its way in, if any of that made its way into those pages, and then, you know, then I'm happy. Mm-hmm.
It was a very powerful scene when they brought him in and he called Clark and, like, literally, like, there he's dying in Ollie's arms and he says, Clark, Clark. And he screams, Clark. And then you see, you know, Superman, Clark, you know, miles and miles away in the Daily Planet, and he hears it, and then he comes and he grabs him and scoops him up and takes him to the hospital.
Wow.
And then when they get to the hospital, you know, Green Arrow is, he's very impassioned, and he's trying to get Hal to go in and try to help him, and he's pushing him, and, you know, everybody's telling him, you need to stop freaking the fuck out, and he's, but you can tell that he feels like, okay, if my kid dies, you know, he'll die, and he won't know, you know, how sorry I am for not being there for him like I should have. Mm-hmm. It was really, really powerful. It was well done, the way they did the exchange.
Yeah, no, that was really, Judd did a great job with that. Like, it was very, like, you know, it was, That Superman moment was so cool, and then later, showing like how, you know, there was a lot of personality there. I think he did a great job, like, showing, you know, like how kind of, you know, how crazy Ollie can be at times and stuff like that. And, you know, and also I didn't know that the Green Lantern had a medical degree. I'm guessing he made one up, like, with his ring, and then, you know, and then walked in and then, you know, decided he was going to take care of something. In fact, probably everything that happened to, you know, to Connor was probably because Green Lantern was in there without a medical degree messing around.
Wow.
Well, he is a pilot after all. So.
Yeah. Maybe he faked that too.
You know, it's possible.
Cliff, can we talk a little bit about like some process stuff too? Like how you approach the work and creating it and all?
Yeah, sure.
Because I wanted to ask about photo reference. Do you use a lot of photo reference with your stuff?
I do a lot of like research for things, but I tend to not use like straight out photo reference. Mostly because like I'm thinking about storytelling in a very particular way, and then usually it requires some kind of shot that, you know, I'm just, you know, it's hard to find exactly what you need. And I think, you know, once you start doing a heavily photo reference style, you're kind of
beholden to the,
kind of handcuffed by it, you know.
Right, right.
You don't always have the freedom to change things that you might, and plus I don't think I'm organized enough to have like one of those, you know, reference files, you know, to really go through. But yeah, I mean, but I'm always looking, you know, for reference for things and trying to understand what an object looks like from every angle. I think it's something that, you know, Noel Sickles maybe said that, you know, if you need to learn how to draw something, you know, if you know how something's built, you can draw from any angle.
Right.
And, you know, and so that's kind of what, you know, has been my, you know, I try to learn it as well as I can, and then hopefully, you know, I can kind of fake it well enough when it comes to drawing into the book.
Nice Noel Sickles reference there.
Yeah. Yes. And your art stays fresher that way, I think, too, probably, you know?
Yeah, it's. I mean, you give up something. You know, it's nice to have that kind of photographic verisimilitude. I think, you know, you really, there's something you gain out of that, but it makes everything else has to be that perfect as well, or else, you know, you start to really notice, you know, like when one thing's photographed, one thing is, and another isn't.
Mm-hmm. And then you end up with people who either have photos for every panel in the comic. Mm-hmm. Or people who just make the shit up as they go, and right. You know, and yeah. And hopefully it works and it looks cohesive. So.
Right.
But
yeah. But you know, I mean, and a lot of people who do, you know, who do a lot of photo ref work, you know, are they're shooting their photo reference themselves too.
Yeah.
So, but
yeah.
You know, I never worked out that setup, so you know, it never felt natural to me.
Mm-hmm.
But you can get some great results.
There's a guy, Tim Bradstreet. There are times when he does his thing, and I mean, it looks fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
As a matter of fact, he did some Human Target covers that were really awesome.
Yeah.
And then there are times when he does it, and the photos, he's so reliant on the photos where it just looks like it's the photo, and he's even using the colors from the photo as, you know, as part of it, and then it kind of loses me a bit. So,
mm-hmm.
But I think a lot of like the power in Bradstreet's work too is the fact that he takes those photos, you know?
right
like that lighting, all that stuff, that style is his, you know.
Yeah. One of the things I'm always impressed by, Cliff, with your storytelling is the acting that you give the characters, like in Dr. 13 and in Green Arrow Black Canary. Like some of the facial expressions and the body language had almost like an Archie like charm and simplicity to it, you know. Furrowed brows and you know, you would do like little lines to come out of the face to show like an excitement or intensity.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And a lot of, you know, a lot of comic artists who are doing superhero comics, that, you know, they won't use those things to display emotion or to make the characters come across. Now, all that was on purpose, I suppose, right? That was just something you were going for.
Yeah. No. I mean, I love that stuff. I think it's part of the language of cartooning. And you know, so whenever I can draw a book and give somebody dot eyes, you know, instead of like, you know, drawn, you know, photorealistic eyes, that's great. You know, anytime I can give them like, you know, sweat beads or, you know, or exclamation. Like, to me, like a perfect drawing, you know, is like when someone is just standing there and then they've got an exclamation point over their head, you know, because you know exactly what's going on, you know, and it's so immediate. So anytime I can do stuff like that, I'm really happy. It's part of the toolbox, you know?
Yeah. It works especially well when there's a book where there are lighter moments than there are heavier moments.
Mm-hmm.
But it is fun, and like you said, it is, you know, it is an ode back to real cartooning.
Mm-hmm.
You know, not separating comic book art from cartooning, but seeing them as being the same. So
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Hey, and we talked about Creeper earlier and on Greendale as well, and I'm not sure, maybe even in some other places, but you've worked with Dave Stewart several times over the years as a colorist. And and he's going to be a guest, an upcoming guest on these esteemed microphones. Exactly. Dave!
Nice.
But what do you dig about his coloring, Cliff, and what do you see him adding to your storytelling, if anything?
I, he's one of those guys that this, he's so great, like, technically,
mm-hmm.
and then he adds to that this real sense of storytelling as well. So he's very aware of things. He's very aware of, like, what the story needs at any given point. But then he also gives enough oomph to an image, you know, to really sell it and make it look interesting. So his palette and his technique they're just really fantastic. And he, you know, he's, like, super easy to work with, really laid back and easygoing. And like, so I'll suggest things to him, and he'll run with it in, you know, in his own way. And so it's really nice to work with him. It ends up, like, not... I worked with him, like, probably the heaviest on Beware the Creeper, because it was such, like, you know, I wasn't sure how I wanted my stuff to look, and we were trying to give the book a certain style. So, like, I was giving him, you know, more notes on those pages than anything else that we've ever worked on ever since. But it was, you know, it was a cool process, and I was learning about color, you know, at the same time. So it was, you know, we were able to give that, make that book look a certain way, and then like other projects have looked different. Like Greendale looked different
definitely.
From that. But he's very sensitive to what the art needs. You know, he's a painter himself, I'm pretty sure. And you know, at any time you get somebody who is that intuitive about art, it is great.
Mm-hmm.
Now, do you color your your work on occasion yourself, Cliff? Because I've seen like several illustrations, like the album covers that we mentioned earlier, where mm-hmm. I didn't see a colorist byline. Like I only saw your name. So would that imply that you color your own stuff on occasion too?
Yeah, I started coloring my stuff with covers. I think those Beware the Creeper covers I colored those, and then as I did more and more cover work, I started to kind of mess around with things a little bit more, and you know, knocking out line work moving towards a style that I'm using now. So mm-hmm. it's and all the stuff that's like on my website, you know, that's all colored by me.
Right.
Yeah. Do you Cliff? Do you get a chance to request Dave as a colorist, or is that something that editorial decides, or maybe you and the writer, well, who'd be good to colorist, that kind of thing, or?
Right, it depends. It depends where I am in the process. Like if I'm like filling in on a book, I can't really bring suggest somebody for a colorist. But if when we started out like with Green Arrow and Black Canary, I knew that I really wanted to continue working with Trish Mulvihill. So we managed to bring Trish over there, and she mm-hmm. did really great stuff on there.
Mm-hmm. I liked Dave's palette on Greendale. It was a lot softer than a lot mm-hmm. of comic coloring is, and it almost seemed like he was trying to capture all of the scenes were like a sunset or a sunrise in kind of a middle American kind of a thing. Like that was almost the feeling I got with the color choices that he made. I don't know if that was on purpose or not, or if I was reading more into it than I should.
Yeah, no, I mean, from the beginning, the editor, Karen Berger, she was like, this is a big sky book, like, you should be, mm-hmm. You should really get a sense of, like, where they are and what the sun and the sky is like and stuff like that. And my idea for the coloring was that I wanted the book, because of the way I draw, it can sometimes feel, like, a little too modern and graphic and, mm-hmm. and as a result, be a little sterile if you color it too straight.
Mm-hmm.
I remember, thinking that this book needed to feel really organic and old, like an old photo album,
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And at that point, I thought, easiest way to do that is to, not have the black line art be black. Well, let's knock it back a little bit. And, I spoke with Dave about that. We tried a couple test pages. And, we really liked the way it turned out. Mm-hmm. So, we went with that. And, I think it gives... The book almost feels like it feels old, and or like it was scanned from an old book, there's coffee rings on some of the pages and stains and textures and, cool. And it looks really cool. It looks like lived in.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I really like the feel of that book, and the writer Josh Dysart, he wrote the script, but it's actually based on Neil Young's album of the same name, right?
Yeah.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a concept album that he came out with in, 2003, I think, or 2004. And it's sort of like, his response to the Iraq War. And mm-hmm. He felt really strongly about it and feels really strongly about the story, too. Like, he created this whole world, with the Green family and, in Greendale and this whole long history. Mm-hmm. So, he made he made his own film about it, and then, mm-hmm. and then someone took that and kind of made a musical out of the album as well, a couple of years ago.
Yeah, a rock opera.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. That's cool.
Yeah, it's interesting.
Departing from the comic book stuff, I wanted to ask, because we were talking about the posters and stuff you did. For anybody who hasn't seen it, you do a search, Cliff Chang, and these 80s style mashups. He did like a Batgirl set in Purple Rain.
Right. And with Batman singing in the doorway looking like a little.
Right. Like, girl, you better come home on time.
Girl, I'm waiting, right?
And it's and you actually end up using that image for your banner at a convention. And then you did another one with Elektra cast.
Flashdance.
Yes. Jennifer Beal in Flashdance. Now, what made you want to do those, Cliff? Because I got a feeling you're a good bit younger than I am, and you don't really know nothing about the 80s, man. Come on.
that's where you're wrong. No, I'm a lot older than I look, I guess.
Okay.
So I grew up in the 80s. I probably wasn't, like, you know, out at any clubs, but definitely grew up, you know, you can't help, you know, 80s. The 80s for me were, like, I started reading comics in, like, 84 and read them for, like, 3 or 4 years, maybe, you know? Mm-hmm. And then, you know, so that period was, you know, listening to the radio, watching MTV, and reading comic books.
Okay. One of my favorite is Vampirella is Rio.
Yeah.
That was just awesome, man.
Yeah.
Awesome. Yeah. So, I mean, I, you know, actually associate, you know, like, the kind of nostalgia you have for superheroes is, like, is really strong, and it's like the same kind of thing that you might have for music from that time too, and that you can, you know, so being able to put the two together ends up being actually a lot more powerful than you might expect, you know, even though that, like, they're kind of not related, you know, in any way, but, like, you know, superheroes are really kind of, they're visual, you know, and they're poppy, and that fits with 80s style really well.
Yeah.
So, Cliff, I got a question for you then, since we're obviously talking about the 80s. I'm looking at the Star Wars banner you did called He Can't Do It Alone, Enlist Today, and it's got Darth Vader in a action pose with a bunch of the rebels, rebel force behind him, or I guess at that time it was the
Imperial.
Well, not really Imperials. They weren't Imperials yet because they just, well, they probably were Imperials because they just turn into the Empire.
Yeah, wrap it up.
Anyway. Anyway. See, I always catch flag when I start talking about Star Wars. That's just part of the problem. Anyway, but what do you think about, I mean, the whole idea behind this whole, not Area 66, but the whole concept behind of the, the Emperor just decided at the last minute in the last movie, which was number 3, which actually should have been number 6, was it called 66?
I'm going to stop you right there.
Okay.
Because I'm going to say, no, I mean, not to be rude or anything, but, like, have you seen those 70-minute Star Wars reviews?
Yeah.
Yeah, they're fantastic. I love them. And because they sum it up for me as, like, those movies make no sense. they don't make a lick of sense to me. Like, I remember watching, I think I watched Phantom Menace twice. I was lucky enough to see it, you know, kind of early, because my brother was working at LucasArts at the time, and I went to, like, the screening, like, about a week before it was actually shown in theaters. And then the following week, I went with some friends to, like, Mann's theater and, you know, stayed in line for a midnight screening and, you know, and watched it again. And I was just trying to think, well, maybe it'll get better, you know?
Right.
Maybe.
On the second watching and stuff like that. And I still couldn't make heads or tails of it. So,
I guess my point, Cliff, is that I really enjoyed what you're doing as far as the posters go. You have the one, the loose lips, sink starships, bring down starships.
Yeah.
That's awesome, because that's straight from Empire, you know, where he started killing all the various, you know, commanders of the ships. So that's pretty cool.
Yeah, I mean, I have a real love for the original trilogy, and I think it's, you know, some really great, like, world building, and I think, you know, of course, you know, Empire and Star Wars are such great, you know, such really great films. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's nice to be able to, like, kind of draw on that and do some funny things that people will recognize, you know, try and mash up, like, you know, kind of take the idea of them being, you know, at war, you know, like, and how, if you extrapolate on that, yeah, they must have had propaganda.
And, like, posters, yeah.
Exactly. Yeah.
Right. And of course, like, the Empire thought that they were in the right, you know, they were, you know, so, you know, of course, you know, so to kind of take American propaganda and recast it with the Empire, you know, in the hero role, you know, I thought was pretty funny.
Right. Yeah. There was obviously no need for any kind of glossing over what the Death Star was, because it's like, rebuild the Death Star. The Empire needs you. I mean, come on.
Yeah, it's a symbol of pride, man.
Right? Seriously. It was cool, though.
Another cool kind of a pop culture thing, is I mentioned the Archies earlier, Cliff, is the variant cover that you did for Archie 600, where you cast the Archies band as a, like, a punk rock band.
Yeah, that was cool.
That was awesome, yo.
Yeah, thanks.
That was
really
cool. Yeah,
they had asked me to do one of the covers for this, for the Hero Initiative Archie project.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so I'm sitting there looking at this double, you know, this cover, you know, the front and the back, and just trying to think, like, what can I put here, you know, and what can I draw, you know, because I didn't want to draw them, like, walking through Riverdale or something like that, you know. I didn't want to do, like, you know, I didn't want to do something that just, it needed to have, like, a little extra something with it. Then I realized, like, you know, that, you know, one of my heroes is Jaime Hernandez.
Yes.
You know, I really love the Hernandez brothers. I love Love and Rockets. You know, it's, those books are actually really important to me as a creator, you know, being, you know, a person of color, you know, like it's just the idea that you can go out there and tell stories about your community, you know, and have them be awesome and to have, you know, have them be embraced by a wider public, you know.
Yeah.
So those guys are real heroes to me. And, you know, I remember, you know, of course, you know, Jaime Hernandez is like very influenced by Archie, by mm-hmm. Dan DiCarlo.
Mm-hmm.
So my way of kind of getting into the Archie universe was through Jaime, you know, and so I thought, you know, why not do this, you know, as like a, you know, kind of a, you know, a tribute to, you know, to that as well. So, mm-hmm. you know, I immediately thought of like them and like as, you know, in a rock band, I thought of, you know, that really iconic Love and Rockets cover that Jaime had done with, you know, at the show.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, but, and, you know, because I'd forgotten that they, you know, that they were a band. And then I started doing more research and I was like, oh, yeah, the Archies, you know. And then,
mm-hmm.
so just, I messed that all up and then, you know, and then kind of threw in, you know, a little bit of, you know, Goofy dressing them up and, you know, a little differently and giving them a little bit more attitude.
Yeah.
So it was a lot of fun to do.
Clifton, there was in the 80s. There was an Archie's television show. It was a half hour television
There's
show.
There's actually one before that too okay. in the late 60s,
right?
Yeah,
70s.
Yeah, and they jammed. They actually had a jam session where they actually would do a song at the end of the show.
Right. Okay.
And it kind of brings back that whole whole image to me when I see this.
Sugar. So.
And the lip sync will be off because, of course, they weren't really singing the song. It was
right.
And they used the same animation over and over again.
Yeah.
But it was cool.
It's the same one where, like Archie's kind of like his head's going like side to side.
Right. Right?
Yeah. Like a little like Beatles style. You know, with the guitar.
Yeah, man.
Great stuff.
Yeah, and he gave Veronica had some tats, and Reggie was the bass player.
Right.
And, of course, Jughead was the drummer.
Right.
So, yeah, that's cool, man. Hey, you talk about, like, what Jaime does in terms of representing his community within his comic work, and in a very natural way, not doing it really deliberately. But I did want to ask you about Secret Identities, the mm-hmm. anthology that you worked on. It came out in, I think, April of 2009, and I've heard you guys are going to do a second volume. Is that correct?
Yeah, they're working on a second volume right now. I think they're getting together some of the stories and trying to figure out who's going to be contributing to it.
Okay, and for anybody who hasn't seen it, it's Secret Identities. It's Asian superheroes, and all the creators, Asian creators, you contributed Larry Hama, Christine Nori, Jeff Castro, Ki Chow, Ming Doyle, Dustin Nguyen, John Sway, Jerry Ma. There's just a long, long laundry list of people who contributed to this book. But how pleased were you with how things turned out? Because one of the things that I heard a podcast interview that you did, you and another guy, one of the other guys, I can't remember which one.
Mm-hmm. And Jerry?
Yeah, I think it was Jerry, and you all were promoting the book. And you had made mention in the interview about having, I think it was you, who had a little bit of concern about moving forward with it and having the Asian characters kind of be moved into this ghetto by themselves. As opposed to being, you know, I guess sprinkled amongst the mainstream. Am I paraphrasing you incorrectly? Or?
Yeah, I think. I'm trying to remember like what I was getting at on that show. I think, you know, I did have some concern that, like, you know, once you have like this book, you know, it's like that, you know, this is, you know, you're telling stories about Asian superheroes here in this book, and that mm-hmm. that they somehow don't, it doesn't have an effect, you know, outside of that, you mm-hmm. know, and that, but, you know, the fact is, I kind of wish we didn't have to do a book like Secret Identities. I wish right. that there were enough people of color in comics and in media in general, so that, you know, you can, that it's a non-issue, you know, mm-hmm. But unfortunately, yeah, you know, there isn't. And so, you know, the guys who put together Secret Identities, you know, I didn't realize that it would be, they did a, something called the Asian American first Asian American Comic Con, I think, also in 2009.
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of to help the release of the book, and there were a lot of people showed up there, and it was really cool to meet them because, like, I didn't realize that, like, the fact that I was doing this professionally, and that because I was Asian, that made me sort of not like a role model, but like it was proof that, you know, someone else could do it. Mm-hmm. And you know, so to make yourself visible in that way, I think I realized that, you know, that it was important to kind of represent more. And you know, and this way, you know, this way some other kid, you know, who's growing up, you know, and sees that book and says, hey, you know, well, maybe I'll give that a shot instead of, you know, hedging my bets and trying to go to law school instead, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right. That's right.
I think that the cause for the book, you know, is absolutely noble and necessary. Now, I do understand what you were saying earlier, Cliff, about, you know, in a way, certain things like that shouldn't be necessary because there should be equal representation in comics for all, you know, races and sex, you know, as well. Mm-hmm. But, you know, increasingly you do find that something I have huge distaste for is how they kind of ghettoize females in comics. You know, why do you have girl comics? Why do you have, you know, this line of comics that are just for, you know, women? If they're good comics, they're good comics, period. Mm-hmm. You know, but you do find that the industry does seem to just kind of break down these different facets, mm-hmm. you know, and to their own little ghettos and try to, you know, just plug creators into them.
Well,
and
see, my thing would be this, speaking purely from a bookseller's perspective from a long time ago, is this. You're trying to find a marketplace for these things. As you're trying to find a marketplace for these things, you have a target audience. And sometimes inside of that, you can, quote-unquote, ghettoize those things. But you have to let people know that they exist and that they're actually out there. Otherwise, they don't know. I mean, you look at comics predominantly. It's males in tights bashing each other, whooping each other's butt.
In America.
Mm-hmm. You know, so it's – thank you, Swan. Yeah. And so, in order for them to be able to present or have a place for people that are looking – females that are looking for comics – you know, they have to let people know, let the female audience know there's something there specifically for them. I agree. In an ideal world, it shouldn't be segmented off in those different situations or different categories like that, because it does have a tendency to make it more stereotypical and somewhat not less than to some degree, because this is a woman's comic. Well, the guys don't have to look at this because it's a woman's comic.
And that's always been my thing is, it's like, and maybe Cliff, maybe this was part of your reservations at the outset of Secret Identities before it came out and it was awesome, was that people might think, oh, well, this isn't for me. I'm not Asian.
Mm-hmm.
No, that's a big part of it. Like the fact is, yeah, like the its identity is a selling point and a dividing line. You know, so it, you know, you hope that you know, yeah. I mean, it's just going to happen. You know, you would hope that, right? That it won't be a special thing. That, you know, a book is, you know, done by all women creators, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But then, like, as soon as you mention that, then someone's gonna think, well, am I not supposed to pick it up then, or what are you trying to tell me, you know? Mm-hmm. People are like so sensitive about things like that. Mm-hmm. Maybe particularly in comics, but you know, so at the same time, it's like, if you try to celebrate that too and use it as a marketing for marketing purposes, right. You know, like that makes sense too, you know. You want to be able to kind of say that, you know, and be proud of, like, you know, who's working on a book and what it's about and what it's for.
Right.
So it just cuts both ways. And yeah. Hopefully, you know, people will be open-minded enough to check it out.
I mean, the idea is to get the butts in seats, and once you got them in the seats, and maybe they'll go and see other movies as well. You know, so
right.
It's that whole thing. We'll walk by and see Contact, and walk by and see whatever MI2 or whatever the case may be. You know, referring to old movies because Swain's got a nice he's got a nice case over here of old movies. So I'm looking over here because I can't pull a movie off the top of my head since we dog Star Wars. But at any rate,
hey, you know me,
yeah, right. Has to be expected. But no, Cliff, I think that's a great thing that you guys are doing, man. I respect that. And, you know, my only thing is I get a little upset by the fact, because I feel as though when I was a kid growing up, I you know, being African American, you know, I didn't see a specific type of character geared towards me, but that didn't stop me from reading or looking at comics. I felt as
right.
Inside those stories, I was able to find myself in each one of those characteristics, which goes beyond simply race. Now, I know there's a lot of things to traverse on a day-to-day basis that people see and have to overcome as far as, you know, stereotypes and racism and things of that nature. But I just feel as though the concept should be strong enough to where it permeates all those different aspects of your life. If it's strong enough, it works. Identify with Peter Parker, identify with Nova, identify with Black Bolt, identify with Galactus, I identify with.
You identify red. With Galactus?
Well, yeah. In my haughtiest of imaginings, you know? I'm giving your world a second chance. But you know what I mean. This is true. Anyway.
So you didn't. Here's a question, though. I mean, like, how did you feel when you saw characters like Luke Cage or the Falcon or, you know? Or Black Panther.
That's very interesting because Swain had a conversation about this earlier, and I never identified with Luke Cage. The Falcon, yes. The Falcon to me was you know, he was somebody that was, I mean, he rolled with Captain America.
Right.
And he was you know, not, I didn't see him as a sidekick. I saw him as an actual valuable asset to that whole situation.
Right.
And when he had his own book for a time, I was like, wow, this is cool.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Christopher Priest wrote that, right?
Didn't he? Right. Correct.
You know? And Black Panther, conversely, Black Panther was always kind of staid to me. Like, he always, until recently when he developed his character more, he was always one of those guys that was regal and didn't say much. Like, he walked tall and he spoke very, very little and was very quiet about his, but he whooped your butt. And he always came in the right moments where you needed him. He was there. So. Mm-hmm. Those are the characters which I kind of relate to, but Luke Cage was too much of a stereotype for me, and he kind of rubbed me the wrong way, you know.
Yeah, I think you know it's tricky because you do have, you know, growing up, like there weren't a lot of like Asian characters that I could really like relate to at all, you know. It was, you know, you either had Shang-Chi who was colored like an Oompa Loompa, you know, he was orange, man, and I was like. You know, I couldn't, you know, I just couldn't, you know, and also, you know, I mean, that was, Shang-Chi's very much like a 70s character,
right.
You know, it's like, it's all about like growing up at that time and being into Bruce Lee movies. And if that's not your generation, I don't know if it speaks to you in the same way, you know?
Yeah.
And then other people that you run into, you know, they're all like, you know, they're not Americans either. You know, they're all like, you got Sunfire who's Japanese, you know, it's like, they all like... representatives of Asian countries,
right,
but there's very few actual like Asian Americans. So you always feel like you're just very conscious of it. You know,
how'd you feel about Daniel Rand then being Iron Fist, and he has an Asian idea of some kind of some semblance of martial perfection, but yet he's this you know European guy with a
you know it's like well that kind of thing happens and it happens a lot, you know. I mean, like, what are you gonna do, you know?
Yeah,
it's cool.
Yeah.
Oh, this is a very interesting conversation we kind of evolved into here.
Kind of end the interview on something serious. All right. There we go, folks.
Let's get those listeners in here.
Cliff Chang, everybody. Cliff Chang.
No, it's good to, you know, but this happened. But,
yeah. So. Well, Cliff, you said you had something you wanted to announce as far as... I know.
I'm announcing my retirement from comics. No, I'm announcing that I'm returning to comics. I think that's what I'm doing. I forget what it is this week.
Wait a minute. Let's put it on the internet. Oh, 20 responses already.
Right? At least.
Well, that concludes another edition of Sidebar. I'm your announcer, Kay McFarland. Thanks for listening. Sidebar is a podcast on the subjects of comic books, art, and popular culture, created and co-hosted by Dwight Clark, Swain Hunt, and Adrian Johnson, and is a production of Ornament and Crime Media, copyright 2011. Any questions, comments, or suggestions for the show, give us a shout at sidebarnation@gmail.com. That's sidebarnation@gmail.com. And you can also find us on iTunes, Podcast Pickle, Digital Podcasts, and all the other podcatcher sites.